On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a potato.
Donald Trump draws protesters in the Southwest. Are they playing into his hands? Marco Rubio says he would be honored to speak for Donald Trump at the Republican convention. Hillary gets slapped by the State Department Inspector General, and states are suing the Obama administration over transgender bathroom use. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor at Slate. And our special guest is Gustavo Arellano, editor of the OC Weekly and author of the syndicated column Ask a Mexican. He joins us on the phone from Orange County. Welcome to all of you. So there was some light violence amid the protests outside Donald Trump's rally in Albuquerque this week. Protesters lit fires, threw rocks, and broke a glass door at the Albuquerque Convention Center. But there were no arrests outside the rally and no reports of significant injuries. Some of the protesters were waving Mexican flags, something that's also been seen at protests outside Trump events in Southern California. And that choice by protesters has come under criticism for playing into Trump's hands politically. Gustavo, you wrote a column this week in defense of the Mexican flag at Trump protests. So why is it wrong to view the flying of a foreign flag as part of a domestic political protest as a symbol of separatism or some other undesirable thing?
What's interesting about this is how whacked out conservatives get over Mexican Americans waving the Mexican flag. They don't have as much of an issue with the Confederate flag. You know, the Confederate flag that symbolize a treasonous, cowardly society that tried to split away from the United States. And frankly, when it comes to these Mexican-American protesters, they waved American flags in the past, back in the big rallies of 2006, even the present day. But it doesn't matter to people like Trump and his followers. They're still going to reduce them to illegal alien savages. So you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. And, you know, frankly, when you're reduced to hearing yourself and your family members to becoming, you know, to being rapists and invaders or whatnot, at that point, of course, you're going to respond back by being proud of the very thing that Trump and his people hate.
But isn't, I mean, a lot of people don't like the flying of the Confederate flag at political events in the U.S., including me. I mean, isn't the sentiment, I mean, obviously there are, you know, the issues about what the Confederacy was founded for that make the Confederate flag
slavery
odious in its own regard. But isn't there something to the idea that, you know, that if the idea is that, you know, we all belong in this country as much as Donald Trump, that we should be protesting under the same flag?
And the great thing about the United States is that you have the right to fly whatever flag you want. As I said earlier, if you had these protesters flying the American flag, that would not change the hearts and minds of Trump or of his supporters. They would still denounce them as, you know, all the things that those folks denounce them as. If you really want to blame anyone for the waving of a Mexican flag, if it offends people so much, you really have to blame, you know, whether it's the Republican Party or the right or whatnot, because again, they've had this campaign of just demonizing Mexicans and Mexican Americans. This is going back to the days here in California of Proposition 187. So this is not like anything new. This is the exact same issue that you were bringing up was happening in 1994 when California ultimately successfully passed a resolution that essentially sought to make everyone and anyone an agent for the, you know, back then the INS, the immigration authorities. And I really think I really think that pundits don't get sort of the mentality of the Mexican American. It's almost like, okay, if you're just going to consider us to be this nasty, race of lowlifes and whatnot, then fine, we'll show you. We're going to wave this flag in defiance of your face. But here's the funny thing. At the end of the day, once you put away those flags, they're all 100% American. They're all consuming American culture. They're all speaking to they're all speaking in English. So, you know, again, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. And, you know, sort of from a reportorial standpoint, I just like to see people flip out with the waving of the flag. If anything, it motivates people more, the true opponents of Trump, it motivates them more to be opposed to him and to register to vote and to make sure he doesn't get elected than just waving the American flag.
I don't know, Dahlia and Rich, what do you make of this? Because I see this is one of many, many aspects of this campaign in which I feel like I see echoes of the 1968 campaign, where you had a lot of unrest for perfectly good reasons. The civil rights movement was by and large correct about the things that it was making noise about in the 1960s. And yet the sense of unrest in the country seemed to do a fair amount to push the electorate back in a conservative direction.
Correct. I mean, the defense offered here seems to be just simple trolling. And these protesters aren't going to take advice on tactics from me, of all people, but I think the American flag would be the most powerful symbol for them to wave at these protests to make the case, one, of their loyalty to the country, and make the case from their point of view that Donald Trump represents un-American ideals. And no matter what flag these protesters wave, of course, they're not going to convince Trump or the hardcore of his supporters. But the point, I would think, would be to reach out to persuadables. And there are going to be, you know, when 60% of illegal immigrants are Mexicans that came here in violation of our laws, there are going to be legitimate questions about how much they truly value this country and the rule of law here. So you'd think you'd want to go out of your way to allay those concerns rather than stoking them. And then finally, if I were going to wave a Mexican flag, I would be really enraged at anyone who disgraced it by committing violence, no matter how light, at these rallies. And I've been very harsh on Trump when he's threatened violence, very harsh when he's defended a few people at his rallies who have punched people. But it is worth noting, most of the violence at Trump events is committed by his opponents, not his supporters, and by people who, in a really un-American fashion, are trying to shut down political expression they don't like.
Dahlia, what did you make of this week's events with this?
Yeah, I mean, I just think Gustavo makes this nice point, and I think the flip of it is also true. You know, this is a lose-lose proposition if you are an enraged Mexican-American being told that you don't count because this election is only about real Americans. If you wave an American flag, you are doing something that would be seen as incendiary and complicated. If you wave a Mexican flag, it's incendiary and complicated. You're being told, in effect, go home and say nothing because this is what it is. And I would just flip it a little bit and say, I think that every single protest and certainly threat of violence is a win-win for Donald Trump. He thrives on this. This really, really goes to, he adores talking about the violence. It's one of his favorite subjects. And whether it's, you know, protesters from the other side, as Rich said, or it's folks, you know, at his events, the fact that people are angry and violent and visceral all accrues to his benefit. And that is probably the saddest thing there is to say, that this really, really does, one way or another, redound to Trump's narrative that people are passionate about him.
There was one other remarkable aspect of Donald Trump's visit to New Mexico this week, which was his interaction with the governor, Susana Martinez, who is a Latino Republican and is the first Latina governor of any state. And she has not endorsed Donald Trump, and he had some fairly nasty comments to make about her in his speech. Donald Trump routinely attacks people in the party who have not supported him, but he said that she's not doing her job and was implying that she was lazy, which struck me as having a racist element to it, but also just seemed like a poor strategy in terms of Trump trying to ingratiate himself with New Mexico Republicans in a state that he presumably would like to win. How did you read those comments, Gustavo?
Well, Trump, we all know how Trump is. Trump is a bore. Trump only cares about himself. This is why the National Review and so many other conservatives from the long time, even to this day, they have legitimate concerns about whether Trump is a true conservative who's going to afford the conservative movement, or whether he's someone, you know, just in it for himself. And Susana Martinez, you know, and this is what I've been telling, you know, it's funny, we're talking about protests and whatnot. And I've been telling this to my Republican friends here in Orange County, California, for years. Latinos, especially Mexicans, especially Mexican-Americans, especially those illegal immigrant Mexican-Americans, believe it or not, they're rock-ribbed conservatives that would be perfect for the Republican Party. They do not like the government. They're all about bootstrap mentality. And I know this because my dad was an illegal immigrant who came to this country in the trunk of a Chevy, and that was one of like seven times he came here illegally. And yet the Republican Party throws it all away by letting their politicians unleash this nasty rhetoric on undocumented folks that, when it it comes to the children of immigrants, you know, people talk about how can these undocumented folks show loyalty to this country? Well, you know, those illegal immigrants pay a lot of taxes. Their children enlist in the United States military, and the first casualty of the Iraq War, Jose Angel Garibay, in Orange County, Jose Angel Garibay used to be an illegal immigrant who got killed in Iraq and only got his citizenship when he became an American citizen. So, you know, I'd have to disagree with Dahlia. In fact, I don't necessarily agree with the violence. I know where it's coming from, but I don't necessarily think that violence and the flag waving plays into Trump's rhetoric, but also galvanizes the opposition. You know, remember in 2012, a lot of swing states that went for Obama was because Romney was talking about undocumented folks self-deporting themselves, and Latinos went out and registered. Now, right now, as we speak, Latinos are registering like nothing like ever before. They're going to be the key in those swing states, and they're going to go for Hillary.
So it's interesting what Gustavo just said there, because it's honestly similar to what a lot of Republican political consultants have been saying for years, this idea that, you know, a shift on immigration policy is the key to attracting Hispanics into the Republican coalition, that this idea that Hispanics are natural conservatives. I don't think this is borne out in the polling data. When Pew polls people this broad question, do you prefer a larger government providing more services or a smaller government providing fewer services, Hispanics overwhelmingly are much more likely to say larger government providing more services compared to white voters. Interestingly, Asians are also much more likely than whites to say that, even though Asians have better income and education demographics than whites. So this is not purely a matter of, you know, rich versus poor stuff.
That's absolutely right. The Hispanics' attitudes toward government are really at odds where conservatives' attitude toward government, conservatives' attitudes towards government are. So it's a much larger issue than immigration, which doesn't mean that you should, as Trump has gone out of his way to do, to insult entire class of people, which is bad politics and just wrong on top of it. Now, this Susana Martinez flap, it just goes to a very disturbing aspect of Trump's political character, which is a free-floating vindictiveness often disconnected to his own self-interest. We saw it with raising the idea that Ted Cruz's father might have been involved loosely in the JFK assassination the day of the Indiana primary, when the race was already over. Everyone knew he was going to win that primary by 15 points and be the presumptive nominee, you know, 6 hours later. And he still did it just because Ted Cruz's father said something that irked him. And it's the same thing with Susana Martinez. It wasn't like she launched a vicious attack on him. She just isn't on board. That really irritates him. And he can't control himself on it on a certain level.
It's funny, though, Dahlia, because he's abusive toward people who are not on board with him. But then when people do endorse him, he has this sort of weird way of treating them that involves still showing his dominance over them. My favorite example of this in the last couple of weeks was him having Chris Christie on stage and talking about how he's boycotting Oreo because the company that owns Oreos is moving some production offshore. And then he points at Christie and is like, he's not eating any more Oreos either. Like, the being his top surrogate does not save you from the fat jokes. And I'm wondering how this is going to affect his attempts to get people like Paul Ryan on board with him if they see that even getting on board doesn't necessarily mean that he'll be nice to them.
I think the data suggests otherwise. I mean, who would have ever thought that Marco Rubio, you know, who took it to the gut over and over again, would turn around and be like, you know, I think I want to campaign for that guy. It seems to me I completely agree with Rich. I mean, these are, you know, not acts of strategic political thinking. This is when Trump lashes out at you, this is an act of dominance. It's an act of shaming. This is just id stuff, right? This is classic abusive bully stuff. And when there are no consequences, when people then come and kiss his ring, when Megyn Kelly says, oh, I love you even more, you great, powerful man, that is also classic abusive stuff. These are victims of abuse who come running to Trump and say, you're right, I'm wrong, I was the abuser here, I was the wrong, I was saying the wrong things, doing the wrong thing. And so the notion that it's going to deter the next person in line to kiss the ring is sort of obviated by the fact that it just is not a pattern we're seeing play out.
Let us know what you think about Donald Trump's sad new fans at kcrw.com/LRC, our Facebook page, or message our Twitter account. That's at LRCKCRW. Up ahead, Hillary's emails and the bathroom lawsuits. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. You can find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts at our iTunes page.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Dahlia Lithwick of Slate. And Gustavo Arellano, editor of the OC Weekly and author of the syndicated column Ask a Mexican, is also with us. So the State Department Inspector General released a report this week criticizing Hillary Clinton over her use of a private email server, saying there was no evidence she had requested or received approval to use a private server and that she had an obligation to seek such authorization. Rich, so as this scandal drags on, I feel like what we're supposed to have learned from it is basically that Hillary Clinton is excessively secretive, that she will go up to the legal line and sometimes over it in order to gain advantage and avoid oversight. And I feel like we already knew that. And I think most people have correctly looked at this aspect of Hillary Clinton and decided that it's not an especially important feature in deciding whether she should be president or not, that there are simply more important things. We got through one Clinton administration that was like that, and we can do it again if necessary. Is there a reason for me to be less jaded about this?
I think so, because it is important reinforcement for that negative brand. And you can date the real slide in her numbers on honesty and trustworthiness, where she's basically almost right there with Donald Trump in terms of people not trusting her, to the advent of the email scandal. And this IG report, you know, is by no means a torpedo to her bow, but it does shred a lot of the talking points that were advanced to justify this arrangement. Like, you know, everyone else did it, of course. Well, other secretaries of state use private email. They didn't exclusively use private email or have their own server. And she oftentimes talks about Colin Powell, you know, which was 20 years ago, and the regulations had been considerably tightened since then to be in accord with the Federal Records Act, which she seems to have been in violation of. So it's not a grievous wound, but it's definitely a cut.
Gustavo, Dahlia, should we care?
No, I mean, I really don't think that the right wing, this is just more fuel to the fire. There's just, you know, next thing you know, they're going to say, oh, Vernon, you know, she pulled the gun that killed Vernon Foster back in the day. If it's going to hurt her in any way, it will be just with those Bernie Sanders supporters who will use that as fuel to not want to vote for her. But at the same time, what this election is going to boil down to is not who has the better attributes, but who is hated less. Hillary has been hated for a long time. Trump is being hated a lot right now. And, you know, each of their supporters are not going to budge from that position. So it's a matter of the rest of the, you know, undecided electorate to decide who do they think is the lesser of two evils. And that's, you know, where have you gone, Joe Biden? A nation turned its lonely eyes to you.
I would just tag up there and say, you know, yes, it reinforces the pre-existing narrative if your pre-existing narrative was crooked Hillary, right? I mean, that's simply not going to be shaken by anything that came out of this report. And this report is kind of a report. And, you know, I don't think it changes a lot of hearts and minds. I will say one of the best pieces I read on this came from Ed Kilgore writing at New York Magazine saying, holy false equivalency, Batman, right? We're saying that she's dishonest because she had a personal server and because she did more or less the same thing to a different degree that her predecessors did, but not different in kind. That makes her dishonest. That makes her, you know, somehow disqualified. And her opponent is somebody who regularly lies about absolutely everything and is forgiven for it because it's seen as speaking truth. I mean, this is bonkers, the notion that these are in anyway, comparable deceptions or comparable levels of dishonesty. Only in a weird false equivalency media narrative is this any way comparable to what Donald Trump does to unbelievable degrees every single day. And we say, that's adorable.
Okay, but I just to push back a little bit, I don't think the claim is that these are equivalent matters, but I think this is more than a purely trivial item in that, for example, the Associated Press and other news organizations had Freedom of Information Act requests out for years looking for communications within the State Department to which they were legally entitled that were stalled on for years in part because the State Department did not have these emails because of this irregular setup in which she was using this private email server. So, as I said at the top of the segment, I don't think this is the most important thing in the world, but I do think that there was a material impact to the public and that there was information to which we were entitled that we were not able to get. And I believe that Hillary Clinton did this setup on purpose because she feels that she has been persecuted by the media. She's not entirely wrong about that, by the way, but because she is so distrustful of the media and of media oversight, I think her instinct is to clam up as much as possible and do as much as she can to control information. And in this instance, it involved doing something inappropriate. It's not the most inappropriate thing that's ever been done in Washington, but I think sort of acting like it was a purely incidental matter is incorrect.
Well, it's a little bit like we were talking about Trump and his vindictiveness. It doesn't necessarily serve his purpose. He's dishonest about things he doesn't really have to be dishonest about. When the thing came out about him impersonating his own PR agent, yeah, very weird, but 20 years ago, and he just could have said, you know, I was pulling people's legs and I like playing around with reporters and I'll never do it again. And instead, he just totally lied about it. And Hillary's lies are more within the norm of political bounds. She, as Josh points out, she came up with this arrangement, not because it was more technologically convenient or she doesn't know how to use multiple devices or whatever else she said. She did it to hide information from the press and freedom of information requests and from congressional investigators. And she just can't admit that because that's too damning an admission. So she lies about it.
I want to get to one more issue before we run out of time, which is this lawsuit that 11 states have brought against the Obama administration, fighting against an order brought down by the administration instructing school districts to accommodate transgender students in certain ways, including allowing them to use the bathrooms and locker rooms that align with their gender expression. And before we get into the policy merits, I want to ask Dahlia, what is the federal law on this? Do you think these states have a case, or does the Obama administration have the power under federal law to tell school districts what to do in this regard?
Well, I think in a sort of interesting way, Josh, this is going to turn on an incredible arcane legal question about whether this is, as the Justice Department and the Department of Education are suggesting in the White House, this is just guidance. Not only is this just guidance, but this is, in fact, just guidance that is perfectly consistent with guidance we gave in 2015 and we gave in 2013. This isn't a different policy. This is us just clarifying what we think the guidance should be. Now, the arcane question might be, is this guidance or is this a mandate, right? Is this the states being told your Title IX monies are conditioned on compliance? That looks like something different from guidance. And so in a purely legal sense, I think that's kind of the question we're going to have to battle through. But I do think the thing that is patently false about this is that there's something new about this guidance. This is a policy that has been in effect probably since 2015 or 2013. And this is simply a way of saying, look, we read Title IX in this way. We've read it this way for a long time. One last thing on this. Most of the federal courts and certainly the federal appeals courts that have looked at this question of whether Title IX applies in this way to transgender students come away exactly where this letter of guidance comes down.
Wait, so I'm sorry. So if it's just guidance, then is the concern that these school districts would have basically that if they do not behave in a way that is in accordance with the guidance, they could then be sued by someone who would claim that they are not obeying Title IX? And then in that court case, the plaintiff would be able to point to the guidance and say the school district had to give me access to this bathroom in accordance to the guidance brought down by the Obama administration?
That's exactly right. That would imply that it's more than just a suggestion. Well, that's the fear that Texas had when they pulled the trigger on this suit. They had already sent a letter trying to clarify, is Title IX money, in fact, on the hook for us? Do we lose Title IX funding if we're not compliant? Now, as I understand it, this suit was a sort of prophylactic. Why wait for that to get resolved? Let's just sue. And, you know, you're going to notice that a lot of the language around this lawsuit chimes exactly with the language around the lawsuit that was filed also in Texas that had to do with President Obama's immigration directive. That's a suit that's in front of the Supreme Court now. And in that suit, as in this one, Texas is not really able to say some harm has come to me, some material harm, right? That's what you need to show. And in Texas, they've been very clear, no kid has been harmed by this bathroom policy. They can't find evidence of that. And in the immigration suit, what what they were forced to say in order to show, oh, no, we can show harm, is, hey, we have to give out driver's licenses to these people who have now been swept under this non-deportation policy. Well, Texas chooses to give out those licenses, those driver's licenses. And so in a way, you have a sense that this is Texas ginning up a grievance and then saying, you made this happen to me. You made this bad thing happen. So they have standing to file suit.
Rich, I've been really struck in the way this conversation has gone down nationally is that the first talking point that I feel like we've seen from the right has been fears about assaults in bathrooms and creating this sort of panic, and then also these like creepy lines from Mike Huckabee about how he wished he knew he could pretend to be a woman to get inside the woman's locker room. And it feels to me like this is playing up fears that don't appear to be borne out in jurisdictions that already have these policies, but I also feel like it's missing what I suspect is the more common concern among voters who are uncomfortable with these policies. Not that somebody's going to assault somebody, but simply that they're uncomfortable being naked in an environment that they don't perceive as sex segregated and
Correct.
Seeing genitals they're unfamiliar
yeah,
with.
Yeah, I think the latter is the more serious concern. And there's no doubt schools are going to read this letter as having an implicit threat that their funding will be cut off. And that's why most schools will fall in line, just as they did with a similar 2011 Dear Colleague letter about Title IX and the handling of sexual assault cases in campus that has led to a regime that's really put due process at threat at these schools. There's a great piece in The New Yorker about the legalities of this latest Dear Colleague letter, pointing out, one, it's very much in dispute whether Title IX, when it refers to sex discrimination, meant to include your inherent sense of gender identity within sex. And that's highly doubtful. And two, the lawful process for doing this when you're going to promulgate such a regulation with such force is you first open it to public input, which wasn't done here. So this is a really high-handed, legally dubious attempt to impose a federal standard on this question that I think individual schools and school districts and states can figure out on their own.
Gustavo, what have you made of this controversy?
Of course, the best pundit or the best analysis of this whole issue was the South Park episode from a couple of years ago that really shows both sides for, you know, what's going on. What's interesting for me here, though, is that, you know, Obama, of course, is going to be representing, or the Obama administration is going to be representing the best interests of who they perceive to be aggrieved minorities in this country. So they want to do that, kudos to them. Unfortunately, he's doing it in an election year where he is basically resurrecting the culture wars that, for the most part, you know, had been long ignored. So what's going to be happening now is that people who might have problems with Donald Trump's not so social conservative outlook, they're very upset by these transgendered bills. They're very upset by the idea that they might be sharing, you know, a bathroom with a transgendered person. And because of that now, they're definitely not going to want to see someone like Hillary Clinton, who's in support of such a mandate in the White House. So now they're going to be gravitating toward Donald Trump. So again, going back to what we were talking about earlier, it's not so much in some – sure, some people might be – thrilled with a Trump presidency, but a lot of people also do not want America under the, you know, not just under Hillary Clinton, but an extension of Obama's policy. So for me, it's interesting to see Obama doing this year, as opposed to maybe even 2 years ago, where it could have been a little bit safer, kind of like with gay marriage.
On that note, that's all we have time for today. We're going to have to forego rants this week, but they will be back next week. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Dahlia Lithwick, and Gustavo Arellano. Laura Dine Million produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Ashleen Knutson is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
I wear pajamas.
You got pajamas.
For
we know we need each other. So we better call the calling of all. Let's call the
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.